welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is Mr. Justin Dower, author of Cultivating a Creative Culture. Hi, Justin.
Hey, Jeffrey, how you doing?
Good. I'm in New York, where we have a terrible heat wave, heat advisory. How's Chicago today?
It's equally hot and muggy, so I think we're on the same page there.
I'll be there tomorrow, but only for a few hours at an airport, so I won't really be there.
Oh, okay, bummer. Yeah. Bummer.
Yeah, no, I Chicago is one of my favorite places in the world, so it's weird, but the airport, I guess, is nice. Maybe I can...
It gets the job done.
It gets the job done. I'm trying a new airport, actually. It's Midway. Do you know it?
Oh, yeah. I used to live right near there on the south side, absolutely.
Is it a nice one?
It's smaller than O'Hare, so you'll deal with a fifth of people, so there's that, certainly.
That's good. I like that.
All right. Yes.
All right. But dealing with people is what your book is all about. How's that for a segue?
Perfect.
So you're a creative director with a background in design. You started as you've been on the show before, and we've talked about your icon work in the 90s and early 2000s.
Correct.
You've been a creative director for how long now?
Well, let's see, probably around 10 years on and off.
And you've worked at American and not American agencies?
Yes, agencies, tech side, studio side. But yeah, I've worked primarily American companies and also Scandinavian as well.
What's the difference?
Well, honestly, the difference, both positive and negative, influenced my book, the takeaways from that. One thing this Scandinavian and Swedish culture brings to the table, of course, is that flat egalitarianism that, kind of permeates their culture just away from from business, and also their business culture as well, in that, kind of everyone has an equal say, everyone has a voice, and at the end of the day, all voices are equal at the table. So that was certainly a huge takeaway from that part of the culture.
That's very unusual if you think about how design is done. How business gets done in most of the world, to my knowledge.
Oh, you said it. You said it. It was certainly a revelation to behold.
So this means that if the intern has something to say, the intern gets to speak and so on. Now, this isn't per se a book about meetings or meeting etiquette, not at all. It's a book about, I'll say it badly, and then you can say it well, but it's a book about the baffling situation where we're trying to get the best creative work we can out of people in design and other creative businesses, but we often put them in a very uncreative environment as far as how our business is structured, how we integrate them into the business, and so on. Is that a fair way of characterizing it?
That is certainly a fair way of characterizing it. And it's shifting from viewing an employee as a line item on a spreadsheet to a passionate, driven, brilliant individual who, like you said, the intern can contribute. You just use that example. Everyone's voice has an equal weight, whether they're a formally trained X programmer, designer, what have you, or not. Everyone kind of brings something to the table as being exposed to the way the business works and the life cycle of a project that they should, be respected for what they have to say.
Now, talk about a new hire. Someone comes into the company for the first time.
I mean,
we've all had experiences. I was a creative director, and my first 2 days after I finally got a seat and finally got a Mac, I spent 2 days putting Photoshop and so on the machines. This was a while ago, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, I had to bring my own stuff because they didn't have it. And that's not an atypical experience.
No.
On paper, I was a somewhat high-ranking employee. I was a creative director, right? So that's kind of a big deal. But in fact, I was just, it was left to me to make sense of where I was and what I was supposed to do and how things worked. Nobody took me through it. And that's been pretty common in my experience working for other people, that you just sort of dropped in.
Right.
And judged on how well you guess what they want.
Yeah, that's... So really this all comes back to the thing we take away from our our formative years. Treat others the way you like to be treated. So as a new employee, you know, with yourself starting, you don't want to be fumbling around and setting up your own computer or asking somebody, where's my mouse or where do I sit or, you know, where's a good place around here to eat? We want to make sure when a new hire is coming on that we're viewing everything through their lens. When we do design and programmatic work, everything is through the lens of what is for the benefit of the user. We're thinking through a lens of empathy. When we factor that lens back on ourselves, we kind of gain this wonderful gift of how we interact with one another. And that charges everything from the first day. And the first chapter of the book is inclusive of a section called The New Day One and about how to onboard. Right. We could flesh that out. It's, you know, from the first day all the way through the day to day, through meetings, through, hackathons. It just permeates kind of everything from that step forward.
I want to talk about stepping through the door and that first day, but I just wanted to say, stepping back for a second, what I really love about this book is the insight is design your business, design your relationships with people the way you design the product that you make, right?
Right.
If you have empathy for the product user, have empathy also for the people who help you make the product.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, as it gets further on in the book, we kind of talk about, you know, you're hiring this talent, get out of their way. You know, not only respecting them, but don't smother the gifts that they're bringing you. I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but ego is a thing that can, you know, absolutely smother those processes in that capacity.
Well, can you be more specific? What do you mean?
Well, looking at when we present design work and when we are doing programmatic work, everything is through the lens of a goal. You know, successful visual communication is established based on goals. We're visually problem solving at that point. When I put myself and my ego and because I said so in front of that, I'm damaging my relationship with my employee. I'm damaging the process of the business, and I'm damaging the end product, all for the sake of, look at me, I'm X director.
You're right, and it doesn't work in client work. I mean, if I say because I said so, unless I'm Paul Rand, it doesn't really work.
It's a finite list, right?
Yeah, it's a very finite list, and I don't think those people are secretly happy. I think the designers who have to actually get into it with their clients and collaborate are happier, generally. Yeah, I mean, if I could just say this is it because I said so, it's orange, deal. That's how it is. Deal with it.
Right.
I think I would be unhappy. And I think the same is, it seems obvious that that should be the case in a creative business. It seems obvious that people should be treated as you'd want to be treated and that they should be thought about from the moment they first walk in. But talk about that some. The it's your first day on the job. What should happen? What could happen?
Right. So I kind of break that first day out into four distinct areas: acclimation, conversation, inspiration, and reflection. So straight away for a new, what I call the new day one, instead of the industry standard, and, you know, industry agnostic even, the standard for bringing an employee on is day one is Monday. And that's because there's a natural organic flow there from there's 5 days standing in front of you. And, you know, someone comes aboard and either they're getting lobbed right into product work, which is a huge strike, or, you know, they're in some kind of orientation or training or something like that. You know, there's 5 days that is afforded there. That's kind of the industry thought there. But what I like to do is bring people in on a Friday. And what I'm looking for there is that generates a completely different energy through this new day one method than starting on a Monday, because, you know, you're overwhelmed coming in on Monday and there's flooding and you're shaking hands and you know you're meeting people and you're trying to ascertain how the business works and how I fit in and what, you know, are there clicks here. By starting on a Friday and kind of bringing someone in this acclimation project, acclimation process, you're bringing someone to their desk and nothing is an unknown quantity at that point. Somebody's not coming to their desk and saying, oh gosh, where's my keyboard? Where's my mouse? Where's my Mac? Everything is there for this person, ready to go. We've thought about all these things to show.
There's a mint on the pillow.
Exactly. We're showing this person has entrusted us with their passion, their gifts. So we're going to make sure that they're it's acknowledged that we appreciate and we respect them. So with this acclimation process, you know, they're not only is their computer and a laptop there, but maybe there's a note. Maybe there's a note from their team that's signed from everybody. Maybe there's some flowers. Again, you know, this is a business, but these are people. So let's think about how these people would like to be brought on. So that's the acclimation process.
How about Q&A? I mean, the first thing I want to know at a place is, do we have a religion here? Do we have a certain methodology? I mean, obviously this would have come up some in the interviews, but what's the real thing? Once you start working in a place, it's different. So, or even just simple things like where do we keep files, or how do we do version control, stuff like that. What about that on the first day?
You got it. So part of the acclimation process is an open dialogue. So if someone's sitting at the table with us, they might ask, are we using Git or TFS for source code management? And I could say, you know, my front end lead over here, he or she can feel that one. That there's an organic dialogue right there. Something else that's a core tenet for someone who is a business stakeholder is ensuring that these aspects of the culture are a known quantity. So if I see someone walking out the door and going out for a walk, I just don't think, oh, that must be a manager or something like that. That's completely wrong. You have to make sure that these gifts, these benefits of the culture are known quantities to this new person coming aboard. Not only is, you know, where the granola bar stored, but also if I need to go get my child from work early, it's not going to be scoffed at or like, oh, you know, you have a half day today. None of that bull crap is going to be happening because right. It's a known quantity. That's just not how work is viewed at this company.
So in a way, you have to be a good company. This process you're describing is great, but it's not going to work at a place where they do punish you for having children or leaving to see your kid's ball game or whatever. Are the ideas in this book things that a business could try? A business that has problems, basically, could Uber fix it? So, well, Uber's a tough one, but could companies fix themselves in part by following some of the guidelines and scenarios that you describe in your book?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly won't sugarcoat it. There are some businesses, and this is, you know, in part why, you know, you and I or anyone else listening to this interview are kind of, you know, move around throughout their career. Sometimes you hit to the point where you can't settle and you know there's it's a known quantity where you need to, you know, pursue your passions elsewhere and you have to leave. So that does happen. But that said, you know, when I've given interviews about this book before, I've talked to people about this book, the first thing that is adopted straight away, by and large, is this new day one concept. And to me, this is the cornerstone for viewing someone as an individual, as a human being. I keep saying human-centered interactions in this book, which is an industry term, but that is the cornerstone for so much more. And, you know, bringing someone in on a Friday, or if you can't do Friday for some reason, on a Monday, still kind of bringing them on in this process. So, you know, that to me is a huge sign to your question that can be chiseled away at a culture that is looking to expand itself. But it all comes back to having an open mind. If the culture is what it is, the founders have been there for 40 years, what have you, and the culture is baked into the day to day. I mean, sometimes you just cannot settle and you have to look for the next opportunity.
Right. It's harder. It's kind of easier, I would think, to introduce these kinds of changes to a bigger place that has sort of that's process oriented, where it's not driven by an individual, or by a new place with an egalitarian founder. It might be hard to do this in a place with a very, I mean, I can't imagine these guidelines working at Apple. Not that I'm saying working at Apple sucks. I'm sure it's great. But what I'm saying is when the founder has had such a profound, every aspect of their personality is baked into the whole thing, it would become harder to create this kind of experience. And I think the fact that you can't can lead to churn, right? I know a lot of people who used to work somewhere. I don't know that many people who stay their whole careers anywhere.
Right. I mean, to your Apple example, I actually cite Apple's onboarding process in the book, at least as of, you know, maybe a handful of years ago. And it's a kind of standard Monday, bring someone in and you know, there's Apple equipment on your desk and you're configuring and you're giving like an iBuddy to kind of work through your onboarding process. But even in a bigger company, if you come in and you're a stakeholder at, you know, director, VP level, what have you, if a culture is generally solid, the impetus is on you then to see where you can take it. I mean, right now I'm at a more corporate business for 9 to 5, and there still is a really good foundation there for culture where I'm able to do these things. Everything I'm citing in the book, I'm able to do because there's a baseline that isn't clearly articulated in their handbook, but it is in mine, and I'm able to do this for my team, and it's not scoffed at in any capacity.
You know how when a team has a certain approach to something, like let's say there's one design and development team in a larger organization, and they're doing something so good in terms of modular design and accessibility that they end up creating a style guide or a pattern library that eventually the whole company uses.
Right.
Do you think behavioral pattern libraries could come out of the kind of work you're describing, even if at first it's only embraced by maybe one group head? If that wasn't a weird question, I don't...
No, I mean, I see exactly where you're taking that. And one thing I could say, at a business I worked at in a couple of roles ago, I was just onboarding people, for example, in the method described in this book for the design team. People I hired were kind of on board in this capacity. And people were kind of noticing in the business and seeing what was happening. And of course, people talk on the day-to-day and, you know, back-end developers or HR or, you know, what have you, strategic people in the business were kind of wondering, why aren't brought on this capacity? And then I sat with the managers and I sat with the other directors and I gave them the tools and the process of how I do this. And they just adopted it, you know, based on how they felt it would work. So, you know, absolutely, this can kind of organically seed itself throughout the business. And as you noted, that it could even be adopted in sort of a human factors library of some sort for onboarding.
I've never seen one of those, but it makes sense that they exist. Let's go back to day one and talk about the conversation, which is the next part of day one, right?
So sure.
You help someone onboard. You help someone learn the processes and, you know, where's the bathroom and where do I keep my files, and then what?
So conversation usually starts around noon. The person has set up their laptop. We've had our dialogue. We've done the tour of the office space. At that point, I'm usually asking people to pack up their bags because I tell them they're not coming back to the office for the rest of the day. The first day one on Friday, ideally, we're not doing work. We're not hitting a timesheet. We're not having any billable job codes. This is all about getting to know this person and translating our culture to them and translating their ideas back to our team and our business. So conversation, again, we have everything queued up. I know where I'm going to take them for lunch. We're not fumbling for anything like that. We go to lunch and we're just going to have like a human-centered conversation at this point because people are going to have, you know, they're going to have food in their mouths and it's going to be between bites of food. We're going to ask about, you know, have you lived in the city all along, or, you know, where are you from? What kind of music do you listen to? More informal things like that. And after that wraps up, then we're going to go to a coffee shop. That's the inspiration part of the program. And we're going to talk about things that are a little more specific to the team. If it's designer or developer, we'll talk about, you know, the kind of design or programmatic work that's coming along, the way we work, and just, you know, about inspiration in that capacity.
You take a field trip as well, do you not?
Yes. So that is the inspiration part. So when we're wrapping up the conversation, I'll say, take me someplace. I'm in Chicago. I say, take me someplace in the city that inspires you. And, you know, things have gone, and as far as typical first days are going, we've gone to lunch, okay, we've gone to a coffee shop, so the person's kind of thinking, this lunch is kind of going on longer than I thought. Now we're even leaving that, and we're taking our inspiration away from the computer realm altogether, the digital realm. So I say, take me someplace in the city that inspires you. And sometimes I've gotten an immediate answer. Sometimes I've gotten people who can't give an answer at all, and I have something lined up where I could take them to kind of talk through something. But, you know, this affords me a level of insight into this person's creative processes, and that's programmatically or design, that a portfolio or a body of work can never yield. Because this person's take me to a place, and if it's a vinyl toy shop, we're not just going to go there and be like, oh, that's cool, okay, let's go. I want to know what about this inspires you. Is it the way the items in here are curated? Is it the way that it makes you feel? Is it something you've collected all along? And then you just kind of dig a little deeper in very human conversation. You're able to garner from this conversation what makes this person tick.
I know that when I've hung out with you, we often go to a gallery or museum or something, just as a way of taking the conversation along certain lines that wouldn't happen if we were just spent the whole day, you know, sitting at a bar or coffee shop.
Exactly. Yeah. So that same logic applies here. And, you know, typically after we've had this dialogue, and this has happened with you and I as well, by the business clock, we're usually at about 4:30, 4 o'clock. And we're not going back to the office at this point. I've asked the person to bring their belongings. This is where the reflection part of the new day one comes in, where I ask them, okay, you know, at this point, think about, you know, what your first day was, and this brings a whole different energy through the weekend, where this person is feeling charged about how they've been welcomed, about this human-centered dialogue. And, you know, I've gotten a hug in the past. People have teared up. I mean, which is beautiful, but it's also a little unfortunate because this person, for the first time, is being likely recognized as a human being and being welcomed as an individual, whereas throughout their entire career, you know, that entire process has been mitigated to, here's your seat, here's your work, let's go.
Often with an HR person or someone who just doesn't get what you do.
Right.
And it's just sort of assigned to put you in a cubicle somewhere. Yeah, I've had places I've gone in and sat for days doing nothing, feeling like I'm going to get fired any second. This can't
be right.
I feel like Big Head in, I don't know if you watch Silicon Valley, the HBO comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But you remember Big Head? He keeps like failing up. He keeps getting promotions and bonuses for basically being incompetent.
Right.
But I've always felt, oh, they're gonna catch on. They're paying me to do nothing. And at first, it's kind of fun, and then it's terrifying.
Exactly.
I think being so nice and saying bye-bye and hugging and everything at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, the person's probably going to go back to their loved ones and say, you won't believe what just happened. I had the greatest experience. And I would think, just speaking selfishly from a corporate point of view, if you want to recruit people, I mean, this is a great recruitment tool. The culture is part of it. And I think what you're talking about transcends the usual way people do culture, where they say, well, we've got this game room, or you know what I mean? We've got paddleball, so we're a fun bunch. Because if you have and there are places that are great and have paddleball and, you know, games and all that, but you could have a very stressful environment where it's not human-centered at all, and then tell yourself, well, we gave them a game room, so they should shut up and be happy.
Right. I mean, you know, getting more macro at this point to the business level, this to the business, the value here is that this directly translates to organic marketing. Like you said, they're going back to their loved ones, they're taking to social media, and this immediately, like, you know, becomes a validation for the company and how they view employees. And it's like an organic ad for the brand at that point.
So now that the person's on board, now that they've have this good feeling, what happens next? What about the life of their career at the company over time?
So I mean, this, you know, once Monday comes along, then we're going to start, you know, talking more about, you know, the actual day to day and how we work as a team and things like that. But you know, organic interactions, you know, using industry terms again, micro interactions about, you know, if you're in a more managerial role, if you're a director, not, you know, backseat creative directoring, as we like to call it, which effectively is tantamount to psychological abuse. And you know, just these little interactions of viewing people as people. And on the day-to-day, what I like to do now is run a meeting every Wednesday called Creative Inspiration Wednesdays. And, you know, people are doing client work, of course, and we have to keep the lights on by doing work at the office. But every Wednesday, we pause for about an hour, and everyone brings something into the office that has inspired them, ideally away from the viewport. Of course, you know, a website or interaction, that's low-hanging fruit. But, you know, sometimes someone brings in a piece of music that they've listened to, or something they've read, or a gallery they went to, and we kind of discuss the artwork and how that made them feel. So, you know, just keeping people charged constantly throughout the week. We're there to work, of course, but we're also there because we're passionate. So you have to constantly make sure those passions are supported and that flame is kind of fanned.
What about side projects?
I think side projects should absolutely be encouraged. You know, of course, people are in this industry because they're passionate individuals. So people are coming in the 9 to 5 and they're doing work. But by and large, people are doing their work, and then they're going home and they're on their couch and they're reading an article on a list apart, or they're tearing apart code from a website, or they're reading, you know, something about responsive typography or something like that. That can be re-engaged back into their day-to-day, but, you know, people need outlets all the time to you know, kind of get scratch that creative itch, if you will. So I think if, you know, businesses that say no side projects or, you know, you can't, your creativity can't have a non-compete in that sense, I mean, that's just really kind of squashing the fire again within somebody.
What about their actual work, how they present it internally? how do you encourage and support people when they're presenting work to you?
Right. So first of all, removing subjectivity is a huge thing. When people put their work up on the wall, it's of course, you know, we're talking about the project, but people are laying themselves bare as well when you're kind of putting your work up on the wall. Of course, you know, people in the industry, we're told kind of divorce yourself from your work at that point. We're just talking about project goals. But that said, you still can't approach something and say, I like it or I don't like it. I've taken those words out of the vocabulary of my team and the businesses I've worked at, because that accomplishes nothing towards the betterment of the project. This is successful really? Because of X. Oh, absolutely. I mean,
I'm always saying, oh, I love that. Because when I mean, not if I don't mean it, but when I get blown away a lot by the work people do. And when I see brilliant work, I just really want to, it's like I want to gush. And am I doing something wrong in your opinion when I tell them I think their work is great?
I don't think it's wrong, but as long as it's kind of couched with something that is a tangible takeaway. I love this. Why do you love this? Or this gotcha. I really like this. Or, you know, why? As long as the lens comes back to, or the language comes back to, this works because it accomplishes this goal. Or
right.
If it's a project that needs a little push, it's not like, oh, you know, this just missed the mark. Then the designer feels like their legs have been taken off from
so
them.
So it's not the creative director like those colors, or yeah, you both like David Lynch movies, so of course you both like this thing, but that doesn't mean that it necessarily is good or good in terms of forwarding the client's business goals.
Precisely. And if we're talking about, you know, presenting client work, you know, some designers and developers internally are doing product work and you know, presenting is not something that's as on the table. But if you're in an agency setting or something like that, we're presenting to a client, you know, before we do that, I always like to give my team, designers and developers, the tools to succeed, but also to let them know if I chime in at any given point, it's not because I don't believe in you or because I think you're wrong. It's because I want to supplement the dialogue. Maybe there's something you didn't consider, or, you know, just know I have your back, because when I was in more junior level roles in my career, I've presented, and I knew, just based on experience, I knew if I did, when I was presenting, they did not have my back. I could get thrown under the bus, or if I just happened to get by in a call and not stumble over my words or miss a point, that I might get taken into an office afterwards and, you know, belittled or, you know, talked down to. And
yeah,
I mean, you know, I say psychological abuse, and I don't throw that out there, you know, without considering the gravity of what I'm saying. It is absolutely tantamount to that. And you know, it can induce hypertension and stress and all kinds of things that are completely unnecessary.
I would love to talk more about the negatives and try to understand where people are coming from or why they do what they do. But we've got to take a short commercial break, so please be patient. And I would like to thank a couple of sponsors right now. This episode of the Big Web Show is brought to you by SendPro from Pitney Bowes. SendPro has 3 times the features of Stamps.com at 1/3 the price. You can print stamps from your computer, saving time and money. You don't need any special equipment, and you don't have to go wait in line at the post office. Just not going to the post office is kind of pretty cool. There's no software to install. It works right in your web browser. You can compare shipping rates and delivery times between the post office and other major carriers to make sure that you're always getting the best deal when you ship packages. You can print paid shipping levels for the post office, UPS, and more. Track your shipments from the same very easy-to-use interface. And Pitney Bowes has negotiated special rates for SendPro users. Savings start at 3 cents per stamp. You're paying less for stamps than people who stand in line at the post office. That's kind of crazy. I don't even know how they do that, but they do that. Businesses can even mail now and pay later with flexible payment options, so that mailing a letter becomes kind of like borrowing money or just using your credit card. That's pretty cool. To check out SendPro, go to pb.com/bigwebshow to learn more. And when you sign up, you'll get SendPro free for 90 days. You'll also get a free 10-pound scale so you can weigh your mail and make sure you're not paying too much. And when your free trial is all over, you'll get SendPro for only $5 a month. And that's $5 a month for the rest of your life, for the lifetime of your SendPro subscription. So if you keep using SendPro for the next 50 years, it's going to cost you $5 a month, even if $5 is worth a penny in, you know, in as time goes on, because you live long enough, you see money get devalued. But nevertheless, $5 a month for the rest of the lifetime of your subscription. Pretty freaking cool. That's $5 a month for SendPro versus $15.99 a month for Stamps.com. Three times the features, one-third the price. $5 a month, you'll never have to visit the post office again, and the first 3 months are free. You can only get this deal for a limited time by going to pb.com/bigwebshow. That's pb.com/bigwebshow to take advantage of this incredible offer. We thank SendPro for sponsoring this podcast, and remember, when you support our sponsors, you're supporting this show. So thank you. I also want to thank User Interviews. Hi, do you design websites and products and such? Do you do interaction design, product design, user experience? Then you probably work with users, and you probably can't get enough of them. User Interviews is the easiest way to find participants for user research studies. It costs $20 for a completed interview plus participant incentive. There's no back and forth emails. You just go on the website, fill out the form, and they start sending you participants. Easy. You can fill studies within 3 days, and it works for both remote and in-person interviews. You can create custom screener questions to help you get specific audiences. Now, this isn't just some weird little fly-by-night thing. This is used by researchers and product managers at companies like Pinterest, Pandora, the Nielsen Norman Group, Wayfair, and more. User Interviews will look for almost any audience except for specific occupations, children, and medical conditions. So if you're looking for 3-year-olds with dandruff, they're not going to do that for you. But pretty much anything else, they will get for you. It's User Interviews. And if you visit userinterviews.com/bigwebshow, they'll waive the sourcing fee for your first 5 interviews. That's pretty amazing. So if you do any kind of design that's used by humans, and you do any kind of human-focused design, and you want to test products and test iterations on users, go to userinterviews.com/bigwebshow. Check it out. Enjoy. Mazel tov. All right, and we are back. I've never said Mazel tov for a sponsor before. I
that was well done.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I always feel weird doing it because I believe in the products, or I wouldn't advertise, but you still... It's weird to, like, read copy instead of conversing. Someday I'll just get so comfortable that I'll just talk, and that'll be great. But not there. It's something to aspire to. So we're here with Justin Dower. The book is called Cultivating a Creative Culture. The phrase, the syllable cult, appears twice in the title. The word creative appears once. It must do pretty well SEO-wise, I would think. This title, does it? Are you tracking on your book website? You must be tracking.
Go ahead. There's certainly analytics. I haven't honed in on the cult demographic yet, but it's being found. I'll put it that way.
This is great. You've been on TV, radio.
I've done some video workshops. Given copious interviews at this point. So the reception has been phenomenal.
Are you surprised?
There's always that fear when you're putting out a book. Is this going to flop? Am I a failure? kind of things. But
definitely.
My hope was, because I know this is a pervasive issue in our industry, and I know people who are passionate want an environment where they can thrive in, and this kind of gives them the tools to do so. So my hope was this would resonate with a lot of people, and thankfully to this point it has.
This is great. I'm very happy for you. I'm really glad you wrote this. Now, you have a little section in your book called Beware the Perk. What's that about?
Yes. So sometimes there are perks within a business. You kind of cited the old foosball ping pong thing before. There are also perks sometimes, like I'll do my best not to name businesses here, but there are some businesses, some larger businesses that have things like
food.
Sleep. Food is certainly one. That's a fairly safe one. But there's like sleep pods. Because Now, with the sleep pod, you can work until 3 a.m. because you'll be rested enough to be recharged and get back to your work and not see your family. Or, you know, you can work until 10 o'clock and we'll do your laundry for you, bring in your dry cleaning. Or, you know, if you work so late, we'll send a cleaning crew to your house to clean up, or we'll give you a cab to go home. All of these things are, by and large, there can be some sincerity behind them. They are, by and large, designed to keep you at the office as much as possible and to be kind of a wool over your eyes towards getting you to do more work. And there have been, you know, viral videos online of, you know, people in agencies and like they're led into a gymnasium and then they're like their family comes across and there's a, you know, 30-foot gap and they hug and then they tearfully are going back to the office because they've been locked down in a project for so long. There are genuine perks. Certainly, you mentioned, you know, food could be one, or going out for coffee, or
even food. I think I know places that have food for their employees every day, and it seems like a nice thing. Like, you guys never have to buy lunch. It's like you're getting extra salary every day.
Right.
But in fact, what it's encouraging is that you never get out of the office.
Right.
And
sometimes the complexity and the delivery mechanism for these perks can fool. I mean, they're designed to fool you. I recall a moment when I was on a flight back from I was doing something in California, some brand research, and it's a long flight. And I had some really long days, and I picked up the in-flight magazine. I started reading, and there was a company who was talking about these kind of perks. I think it was actually the sleep pod thing, and I thought, oh man, that sounds pretty good. I could have used something like that in my trip. And then I snapped out of it. And I think, what am I thinking? You know, this is a healthy, unhealthy, I should say, mechanism to get somebody to work longer. And it sounds, to the beleaguered creative individual, it sounds like something that's designed to help you rejuvenate and recharge, but really it's designed to keep your ass in your seat longer.
So you talk about it, but I'll pretend I haven't read your book. What are some good perks?
So some good perks are, for example, let's talk about the conference perk. So it's one nice demonstration of a healthy culture is if the business will send you to a conference, and of course that's inclusive of airfare and hotel and paying for your meals and your meals and submitting an expense report, what have you. And also you're going to a conference and you're ascertaining, you're getting knowledge from this conference, and maybe you're making some industry contacts. That's a good general sign of a good healthy perk of a healthy culture. But, you know, we can also take that a step further, because conferences are obviously wonderful, but you're being talked to. You're not really engaging back with the speaker unless you have the opportunity to kind of engage with them in the lobby or something at some point. So if we consider, for example, the spirit of a hackathon, where people are kind of coming together, hopefully designers and developers, and they're kind of throwing down towards a common goal. We can take that perk, that general good sign perk, and push it further. So one thing I talk about in the book I developed with a colleague of mine, Andreas Carlson, was this concept called a winter camp, where we took people from the business. We were able to, I think we took maybe 12 people, and we took them in the middle of nowhere in rural Sweden to this cabin, and we all just – people from different disciplines who you might know from an email chain or something like that, you're able to put a name to a face. And we just kind of cooked together, and we cleaned together, and we designed and created and programmed some projects and tools that we were able to take back to the office and reinform our work. But, you know, it just recharged everyone completely, because there was a dialogue. There was an exchange of ideas rather than being spoken you're speaking with somebody, and I'm humanizing them. I'm garnering their creativity and the results, their insights from, you know, somebody I might just see, like I said, an email chain or a Skype conversation. And so it afforded humility, it afforded inspiration, and afforded putting a soul to somebody who's just a name on your screen, typically.
It sounds almost like the way certain religious groups work, or the way Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous work, where you're part of a community that cares about you, and at a certain point you just get to kvetch or talk about what matters to you, and it's kind of a supportive environment where nobody's going to judge you.
Correct. And of course, humility has to absolutely be baked in these and interactions, because there are, I mean, the goal is to get people from all levels, like just if you're running a workshop, and the goal is to kind of get people from all levels of seniority into a workshop. In this example, you want to kind of do the same thing. You want very senior level people and very junior level people, because, you know, everyone kind of brings something different to the table. And if humility is not a part of that, that cancerous ego is going to present itself and kind of, you know, taint the entire atmosphere.
It's almost like a good kickoff meeting, where the point isn't to necessarily make the important decisions, but the goal of a good kickoff meeting is to get just strip the veneers off everyone to some extent, and just, you know, the outsiders, right? The outside consultants, the differently siloed employees that, you know, are suspicious of each other, the executives, that, you know, everybody sort of just becomes a person contributing, and it's almost like a work kind of party or something. It's just another way to interact.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a very good analogy.
I was wondering what, besides the, you know, having worked at the Scandinavian place, what led you to write this book? Were you trying to solve a problem? What were you trying? What was the inspiration?
Well, the impetus for the book was the article that I wrote for A List Apart, and that was Resetting Agency Culture, which, of course, you could tell from the title, is through the lens of an agency specifically. I've worked for many an agency in my you use the term serpentine career, I think, in your foreword. I like that term, serpentine career. And agencies kind of have some inherent issues in terms of how they I talked about the value of time, and I talked about time machines and things like that. So that was kind of really keenly in my mind at that point. So I wrote the article for List Apart, and the feedback that came back was not only very, very positive and impassioned, but it also came from people across all forms of media. It was people in television, people in radio, people, and of course, in web. And that really, I let that sit with myself for a little bit, and I let it gestate. And there's a bigger idea here. This concept transcends the agency, because, you know, there are takeaways that are applicable towards any business. You know, I kind of lead chapter two with Nick Cirillo, the pizzeria owner, right, for example, even, because this is a guy who, you know, owns a couple of pizzerias, but he's a TEDx speaker, and he's been in Fast Company, and you know, he's been published all over the place because of the way he runs his business and the humility he instills and the tools he gives his employees to thrive. So, you know, that general sense that this is a bigger idea than just the agency really was the impetus for crafting this book.
That is great. And when you wrote the original article, were you angry? Were you frustrated? What was going on there?
Well, you know, I'd be lying if I said, you know, that wasn't part of the fuel to the fire, but it wasn't written as a negative piece at all. Like I said, the book is written, you know, in the same way, taking the negative and the positive from my career, from people I've interviewed, from people I've talked to, and refactoring that into the tools to thrive. It's not just a book about, you know, chest thumping, raving, hands in the air kind of book. It really is there to give people the tools to contribute to creative culture, to find their own creative culture. You know, because the book kind of wraps up with perhaps oddly outwardly giving people the tools to find their next role. If they're interviewing, I end the book with saying never settle. And I very right. strongly believe in that, never settling, because losing years of your passion, your career, really is the most unfortunate thing.
It's a really important point, which I had neglected. It sounds initially like this is a book for managers, it's a book for directors, it's a book for people at an executive level, but that's not the only audience that you wrote it for. You did write it for any employee to be able to evaluate where they are and where they should go if they're unhappy. Do you offer methods for, I mean, some people in employment situations just feel helpless, right? They are afraid to move on for whatever reason, and their situation is not nearly as benign as the kind of culture you're recommending. What should people like that do?
Well, so earlier in my career, I was in a role that was the culture was cancerous and it was toxic, and many of the things that I cite in the book kind of came from there. When I cite some negative tenets. And in that instance, I had absolutely nothing lined up And as another, I wasn't interviewing and I wasn't doing anything. And my creative passion, my fire was absolutely extinguished. I felt just personally, I felt like garbage. I was belittled. And I came home that week and I told my wife, I can't go back in Monday. I'm done. And there was just the complete support. It was just, okay, I believe in you. So I went in and there was a lot of work going on right now, so I wanted to quit on the spot, and I gave them my 2 weeks, and they said, oh, 2 weeks, guess what, you're done now. So that kind of confirmed my decision. They just told me to go home when I gave them my 2 weeks. Wow. But at that point, you know, you still have to pay the bills, and you have to keep the lights on. So at that point, you know, I was not only analyzing what I wanted to do with my career, but I was scrappy as hell in terms of, you know, shaking the tree for my contacts or places I previously worked. And I was doing PHP development. I was doing design, and I was doing WordPress template, anything I could do to bring in, pay the bills at that point, while still, you know, being true to myself and saying, if I'm going to take on a next role, what do I want to do? So to your original question, I got a little tangential there in terms of giving people the tools. I tell people, if you see toxic signs, you can't settle. You have to, you know, I say if you're a new hire even, and you've been there, you know, God, 24, 48 hours, and you start to see things that were not true to the interview, things that were not true to how the website represented itself, to how the stakeholders you talked to represented itself, give it, you know, 5 days or 2 weeks, and then get the hell out of there. Because really, who do you owe at that point? Do you just societally owe it to the business because they gave you a job? No, you have to ultimately look out for number one at that point. You have to look out for your best work. So, you know, I call it the 5 day principle.
That's great advice, because I know from experience, if you don't get out quickly, you get sucked in.
Yes.
It's like a bad relationship. If you realize early on, oh, we're not compatible, you can get out with very little harm done and mutual respect and all that. But if you stick around for a couple of years because you're not sure how to break up, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare for both people, and it just gets worse and worse. And work is exactly the same. I've been in a place I hated for 4 years. You know, I'm old enough to have had that experience. And, you know, I still have a good career now, looking back. But definitely, mine was quite serpentine as well and bumpy. And 4 years at a place that you hate, and I'm not saying that the place was bad. It was just a bad fit for me.
Exactly. That's a good delineation to make. Yeah, so I mean, you know, I say never settle, and I've done the same thing as you have, where I've languished at places for 2 years, 4 years, 5 years, and I look back and I just wish I had taken my own advice more often than not. So that's why I felt that was a very core important point to make in the book.
You know, I got started with table layouts. I think it's really important that when you have something to say, that if it comes partly from pain of having done something the wrong way, having made mistakes. I know Mike Montero, in his book, Design as a Job, said, I got these stories by making all the mistakes I hope you won't make. I'm paraphrasing badly, but he, you know, basically said, I learned how to do this stuff by doing it wrong first. And I hope, and I'm saying, telling it to you so you won't have to. There's something really nice about turning that negative, like that initial negative that maybe, you know, led you to quit your job and it was the initial spark for your original article, and turning that into a positive program of how can I help other people, like, you know, not settle, and how can I help businesses that are struggling find a better footing. I think that's really great stuff, and we're going to come back and talk about it in just a second. But I have to thank some more sponsors, because look at this, we're so popular. I want to thank Blue Apron. Everybody knows Blue Apron. They are the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. I'm assuming by now most people hearing this know about them. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And they achieve this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. This is really, really true. And it can turn even people who are unskilled at chefery into decent cooks. I know, because I am one. It really does work. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. As a result, seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals. Produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're reducing food waste. This is another huge thing. If you if you're single or a small family, if you're just a couple or a parent and child or something like that, you can waste so much money on, you want to eat healthier, you want to cook healthier, so you buy all kinds of great fresh produce, and then it goes bad in your fridge because you don't use that much of it at any given time for any given recipe. And Blue Apron just nips that in the bud. They go get this great farm-to-table stuff, this locally sourced stuff, and they bring it to you, and it's only what you need to make this incredible recipe. And whether it's a rare spice or just a couple of veggies, you know, a couple of organic carrots or, you know, one small zucchini or something, whatever you need, it's what you need to make that food and not have food go to waste, which is huge because food waste not only is expensive and depressing, it's also, it contributes to climate change, right? Because we got a landfill filled with decomposing food, and that's very bad. So cooking together builds strong family bonds. It's a lot of fun if you have a kid or kids to cook with your kids. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. For people who are creative and busy, it's something you can do in about 20, 25 minutes. It's a creative activity you can do with your family instead of watching TV or before watching TV. And those who spend a lot at restaurants or high-end grocery chains can now spend under $10 per person for a delicious, healthy meal. Upcoming featured meals include fresh basil fettuccine pasta with sweet corn and cubanelle pepper. Creamy shrimp rolls with quick pickles and sweet potato wedges. Man, I can't even say this stuff. I'm getting really hungry now.
Likewise.
So it's affordable, less than $10 a meal. It's seasonal. There's a lot of variety. They don't repeat like ever, which is crazy. It's flexible. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. They always have more to offer than you necessarily need. So you can say, all right, I'll take this and this and skip that and that. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less, usually much less. And guaranteed, Blue Apron's Freshness Guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives fresh, wholesome, ready to cook, or they'll fix it. They'll make it right. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/bigwebshow. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So please don't wait. Go to blueapron.com/bigwebshow. That's blueapron.com/bigwebshow. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And hey, one more sponsor to thank. Amazing. ZipRecruiter. Question, are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? It's not easy, but with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100+ job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. Are you building a creative culture? You can't do that without people. People are the number one thing you need. And with ZipRecruiter, you'll find the people. There's no juggling emails, no calls to your office. Just screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. English is hard for me sometimes. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's correct, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/bigwebshow. That's ZipRecruiter.com/bigwebshow. One more time, try it for free. Post a job listing for free. You need someone. You're building a creative culture. You're cultivating and building. You need people. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/bigwebshow to try it absolutely for free. That's pretty amazing. And we are back with Justin Dower talking about business relationships and Cultivating a Creative Culture. That's the name of the book, Cultivating a Creative Culture. The important takeaways: don't settle. Don't settle and don't settle. Don't settle for a hushed voice. Don't settle for burnout. Don't settle for frustration, whether you're the employer or the employee or both. It's a very inspiring book. Justin, you write about the mutual win. What does that mean to you, and can you explain a little bit?
Well, really, the mutual win is about for business and employee. So, you know, I want to make sure it's a known quantity that this isn't a book about, you know, it's not a new agey book about crystals and incense. This is an actual book that, you know, yields results for, you know, when a happy and inspired employee does phenomenal work, which translates to business success, which translates to profit, which translates to brand recognition. So the mutual win is really for the business and the employee. If the employee is well supported and feels like they have the tools to succeed and thrive in a non-patronizing sense, I mean, they're going to do good work. They're going to be charged to come in and create. It's going to help their ideation processes. It's going to help their interactions. And that's going to make the office environment more dynamic and charged. And that's going to lead to organic marketing for the company. It's going to lead for, you know, it leads to phenomenal work. So it's just a cyclical process of you know, people being recognized humbly and, you know, and them in turn doing good work for the business.
Cultivating a Creative Culture, where do people find it?
Thankfully, you can find it just about everywhere online. And then, you know, the website for the book as well is the-culturebook.com, which has, you know, many a buy now button. It's available in paperback and ebook or iBook or any you know, digital book you can think of. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, what have you, online. It's everywhere.
That's fantastic. Talk a little bit about because, I mean, it's obviously it's a successful book. It's hitting a lot of nerves. But this is also a self-published book. So let's talk about that. Because there may be someone else who has a great idea who's listening to this and goes, well, that's easy. You know, for Justin, he was this famous guy and he went to this big publishing house. But that's not really how this happened. How did you come to publish this? And talk a little bit about the journey there, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. So first, we started talking about this together initially. It was a process that we were kind of talking about. Maybe this is a good fit for a book apart, and you know, maybe this is something we want to publish there. And eventually, ended up self-publishing, and you know, that it's a challenge, and it also affords you a kind of a greater degree of, I guess, creative control. And the thing is, you know, as it is with this book, tenacity is absolutely key. There's no easy way. You know this very well, Jeffrey. There's no easy way in publishing. As a publisher, as a writer, there's no easy way to get this done. It takes tenacity. It takes humility. It takes a great deal of humility in writing, I found, to, you know, get to the best source material. So, you know, in going through this book, you know, it was ultimately hiring an editor, working with an illustrator who thankfully was is a really good friend of mine. I think his illustrations, his name is Bobby Price. His illustrations absolutely bring the subject matter to life. And
they're fantastic. And also your type and color schemes and everything. I think that you answer the client's brief. I didn't mean to say I like it. I meant to say you answer the client's brief. No, it's great. It's absolutely great.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so, you know, by ultimately with cost, by writing it and designing it and using my own photography, that was able to mitigate cost a bit. But, you know, you have to consider this ultimately if you're in self-publishing as an investment. It's an investment of your time. It's a financial investment. It's a creative investment, and you know, the ultimate takeaway once you get to fruition and completion is one that's ultimately of a great deal of fulfillment. You know, so once just writing the book is just a small piece, then it's promoting it. I have a promotion company who's helping me along the way with you know, different engagements or seeking out opportunities I might not have considered. So it's just making sure you're well supported. As with anything, you're well supported to succeed and thrive.
That's fantastic. And people can also go to twitter.com/the_culturebook.
Correct.
They can go to the-culture. Wait a minute. Oh yeah, that's crazy. It's the underscore culture book.
On Twitter and Instagram, correct. But the website is the-culturebook.com.
What was the thinking?
You know, I don't recall. At the time, there was a really good answer for it. I don't know if hyphens are unusable or how I netted out at that point. But obviously, that's not a good strategy for a website. So the-culturebook for the website and the_culturebook for social media.
Just go to Pseudoroom. If you go to twitter.com/pseudoroom, right, it links to everything, or pseudoroom.com. Correct?
Yes, correct. Correct on both fronts. I'm Pseudoroom on all forms of social media.
Pseudoroom on Pinterest as well?
I don't know if I have a Pinterest. I think you got me on that one. Darn it.
What about, but you do have a,
I got
the photo one.
Instagram, yes.
Instagram. Pseudoroom on Instagram. Who does the photography for you? It's pretty amazing too.
In the book?
No, in Pseudoroom Design, for example.
That's my photography.
You took that picture of yourself?
Yes.
That's incredible. Okay, and, you know, people can't see it, so they'd have to go to pseudoroom.com and then they can. But we're talking about something on an audio program, and I'm saying, oh, that looks nice. That's really remarkable. It looks like it was shot on a metal plate.
Yeah, that took some photoshopping. But
photoshopping. Yep. And then there's, of course, the Pixelicious. This is great. It's just great. Trust me, everybody. Go check it out. Pseudoroom Design, pseudoroom.com.
I'm actually in the process of redesigning now, so. Get it while it lasts. Well, yeah. You know how it is.
I do. But why are you redesigning?
You know, it always comes in bursts of inspiration from something. For this, I was writing a positive energy from the book release, and it really fueled me to take a look at what the site, the Pseudoroom site is doing right now for me, and what I'd like to do, what I wouldn't do. I, you know, for the Creative Inspiration Wednesday meeting a couple weeks ago, I brought in the Art of Tron Legacy, and I talked all about Tron Legacy and the interface for that movie. And one of the things I cited in that is when I came out of that movie, I instantly had an idea and a concept for redesigning my site, and I was super charged from the visual design of that movie and the interfaces to come back, and I was immediately, you know, sketching things out, and I was wireframing and I was designing, and so, you know, it's just all about inspiration.
This is terrific. The gentleman is Justin Dower from Chicago, iconist, artist, writer, publisher, UX guy, bon vivant, dad, wearer of denim, drinker of coffee. You can find him at Pseudoroom on Twitter and on Instagram. And the book is the_culturebook at Twitter and the-culturebook.com. Justin, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. And it's been great. It's been real. I want to keep, you know, hearing about the success of the book and wish you the best of luck with it. And I encourage folks to get a copy and read it.
Thanks very much, Jeffrey. I appreciate the opportunity again.
Thank you. All right. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another Big Web Show.